The lights are on red. We're away.
Hi, welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Sunday, December 10th, 2006, and this is episode 71. My name is Jules Cisak, and I'm sitting in for Bob Hayes and Jim Race. Now, this is my first podcast, so bear with me. And this episode mostly consists of a conversation I recorded with Liam Schubert earlier this week. And if you've listened to the show before, you know who Liam is. And I'm sure you know that you're in for a treat. And if not, just hang in there because you are. Before we begin, just wanted to catch everybody up on the status of the show. So Bob started the podcast back in the spring of 2005. He built quite a amazing fan base due to his professionalism, you know, both in the research and insight department as well as scoring some really fantastic interviews. And then, as you know, back in June of this year, Bob shipped out to Iraq with the U.S. Naval Construction Force, known as the Seabees. And now he's in Iraq. He's him and three other guys are driving around in a Humvee, escorting supply convoys. Some dangerous stuff. I actually got to exchange some emails with him yesterday. He's doing very well. He's joking around, and he finally got to see the final round of Valencia from October. So anyone who's been holding out and emailing Bob because you're afraid to spoil the season for him, you can email him now. It's safe. The show is back. We're going to do one more show this month, and then we're going to start a more regular schedule in 2007. And that's about it. Now I'm going to play for you this conversation that I had with Liam on Wednesday. Enjoy.
All right, we're on.
Hi, everybody. This is Liam Schubert calling from Barcelona, Spain, and we're here to kick off the return of MotoGPOD, your internet podcasting with all things concerning MotoGP. A year ago was the first time that I was on this show with Bob Hayes, the original podcaster, and at that time I was scratching and looking for work in MotoGP, and here we are a year later. And I've worked a season with Dantin MotoGP, and I've re-signed to work with Primac Dantin MotoGP for the 2007 season, this time with a slightly different position than mechanic. So you may have heard of me across the internet forum boards as Moto Liam, but that's who I am, and I'm here to talk a little bit about MotoGP.
Thanks, Liam, and why don't you tell us a little bit about your new position and what's been going on.
Okay, in 2006, I was picked up starting at round six, the Mugello round, and I got hired to be the last mechanic working for Alex Hoffman because someone else didn't work out. And previous to working the Mugello rounds, I'd been working for Luis Dantin, running as a mechanic for the Lasai National Cup, which is a five-race series that he manages in Qatar for their national riders. So he knew a little bit about my mechanic ability, and then he gave me a shot to work with the GP team. So I jumped the chance, and I worked out the rest of the season and assisted with everything I could. Basically, I managed tires and fuel and worked on consumption and learned everything that I could from everybody that I could. I mean, it was an exponential learning experience for me this past season. Everything that you see from the outside or you can see from an internet forum or a website that shows even some technical information, it's nothing like being deep in it and just having the stuff around you, 12 hours a day. where you can pick up something and ask somebody a question, and somebody with more knowledge or experience than you, you know, will explain it to you, which I think because my team was one of the smaller teams, I had that opportunity to learn a lot more, because it seems like on the bigger teams or the factory teams, you are stuck just focusing on your job specifically, and you don't ask questions, and you're not allowed to press people for information, they're not willing to share information with you because no one wants you to really improve out of your position. They're not there to teach you. They just want you to do what they want. And I've got some neat examples of that that we can get into later.
Wait a second. You're saying that this is the way some of the teams work right now?
Yeah. I mean, they're not.
That's harsh.
They want you to be good by the time you get in there. You usually work your way up through various national series and then maybe 125, 250, and then GP. Nobody really jumps straight into GP, but I got lucky. And I think, I thank whoever's out there for letting that happen. But definitely there's a big difference between a privateer team like mine and a full factory team. And even the factory teams are quite different. The most notable one would be HRC, where I know that the data acquisition guy that has worked with Pedrosa for years, you know, downloads the data, analyzes it, goes over it, makes suggestions, and it's an active part of, you know, the setup of the bike. Every time the bike comes in, every couple of laps, you know, he has something to say. But now that he's working for the HRC team, his job is to download the information from the bike and pass it to HRC. And he's not allowed to look at the full spectrum of information that's coming out of the bike because HRC is a little secretive on what he can look at and what he can't look at. And that's one of the differences that I'm aware of. Whereas on my team, we're a little bit more open with our information because I think everybody has to work harder. There's less of us, less people on my team, and we all kind of lend a hand, and it's a little bit more of a family atmosphere. You know, if I see something on one of the graphs when we've got multiple graphs up on the computers, you know, I'll ask. And if there's time permitting, you know, someone will explain it to me. So it's been a fantastic year for me as far as learning about how the front of the house goes, what happens in the garage between sessions and what we do in the evenings to get our bike ready for the next morning. It's been great.
So when you were this year in 2006, you said you worked on tires and fuel, but so you're saying, you're like implying that you were able to be involved in other aspects as well, right?
Yes. Generally, there's such a time constraint. That's the main factor, because the two sessions per day that run at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock in the afternoon, if the session's 1 hour long, then if something happens at 11 o'clock, the bike comes in, it's smoking hot, and you got to do maintenance to it, so that you're ready to run at 2 o'clock, or if there's any kind of crash damage or serious modifications that you have to do, you only have a few hours to do it. And, you know, ironically, that's when you want to eat lunch. So sometimes, you know, you lose your lunch break, or you just, everybody pitches in. And every weekend we're changing engines out. And, you know, certain bikes it's a little easier to work on than others, and I think this philosophy is carried over. You can see on some street bikes, it's pretty simple to change out an engine or a swing arm on certain street bikes, and then on others, it's a little bit more time-consuming. So with our bike, we were running a combination GP5, GP6 in 2006, and it's a bike that needs a lot of hands, and they all need to know what they're doing because there's a lot of intricate pieces. It's not quite as basic as some of the other machines. So, you know, even from my first weekend with the boys, I was helping change motors and getting right in the thick of things. They know I know how to turn a wrench, but the language barrier was kind of a difficulty throughout this season. When you're trying to do something complex and someone's trying to explain it to you in a foreign language, it just makes things doubly difficult. So if they could show it to me and I understood it, then I'd go ahead and keep doing it. Nobody would have to say anything. But it does kind of put a limit on what I'm able to do. for the future. So until my language ability improves, I kind of felt that I was not able to help as much as I wanted to.
So the bike was a GP5, GP6 combination. What does that mean? What parts
were... We had the GP6 chassis. We didn't quite have the same electronics that the factory had. They were working on a variety of things. And there were some engine differences that became apparent as the year went on. Mostly, though, I think a lot of it, I don't want to say anything bad about anybody we've worked with, but with the package we were running and the dumb-up tires that we had for our machine, I don't think that increased power would have done for us.
Yeah.
I think we really needed electronics, and I think we needed a couple of things to kind of come together. But so far, I think in the preseason that we've been running, now that we're linked up with Bridgestone and Veros has already ridden the GP7 for 2 days, I think we're looking strong for next year. And I don't know. I'm really excited, but at the same time, I'm not going to be as physically. I'm not going to be working on the bikes as much because I got promoted to take over my team's parts and logistics position, which will see me working for both riders. And basically, I'll spend most of my time dealing with the chief mechanics, the Ducati Corsa engineers, and the lead mechanics. Because if they need something, or if they need to communicate that we want this from the factory, or we think this could be better, or something along those lines, then it's up to me to facilitate that. And, you know, on a daily basis, I'm in communication with the factory now, lining up the pieces that I'm going to need for January, because we start testing in January on the 22nd in Japan, and things have to ship out of Europe by the 10th. So it only gives us 30 days to put together a couple of weeks worth of gear. Probably it's going to be the whole season's worth of gear, and then we'll continue to order as we need parts. And as new parts get developed and offered, then I've got to stay on top of that and get rid of the old stock and bring in the new stock. So in the last few weeks, I'd say the last 30 days have been kind of overwhelming for me once this position became more solidly in my grasp, because I've got, you know, 33 pages of PDF form just filled with part numbers and filled with Italian that I've got to learn. So it's been wild. I mean, I know where a lot of the basic components go and where some of the smaller items go, but I'm building in my head a three-dimensional image of the bike in all its different layers. And I don't know, I'm on such good terms with everybody that information is pretty nice and free-flowing to share, and just really excited to be in the position I'm at, because it's a chance to learn and grow, and that's, you know, all I wanted to do with MotoGP was be involved, and now I'm integral. So I have to thank a whole bunch of people, which I'll get to that at the end of the phone call.
Okay.
Because we don't have enough time now.
I wanted to also ask you, you know, last year you talked about there was a couple of races that your containers arrived late, I remember.
Right.
So are you going to be the guy who now is, like, extra paranoid about that stuff and taking the fall for it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, ideally, I have a separate coordinator that I will work in partnership with, and he's the one that handles all our flights and hotel rooms and rent a cars, and also will assist with shipping of the containers. But in those instances where our shipping containers are late, it's never really been the fault of a team member, because we've got such a system, and it's not just our system. There's a giant shipping company that Dorna contracts, and they bring the semi-trucks and the forklifts, and we'll load everybody's boxes up onto the back of these trucks and get them to the airport, and they know, okay, we've got two planes, and we're going to load up the planes, and everybody's stuff will get there at the same time. Everybody loads up at the same time, and all the stuff should arrive at the same time. But for whatever reason, customs held up a couple of boxes or our entire shipment at various times through the 2006 season. It does put a real pressure when the boxes aren't there on time. You lose time, and You know, there's no way to make it up except, you know, by spending the night hours doing it. So, God, I hope that doesn't happen.
Yeah. All right, so let me move on to the actual testing. So, obviously, Barros kind of surprised everybody, got back on the bike, and was faster than the factory team on the final day of testing. I heard that he actually ran on the qualifier as opposed to the factory guys, but still, it's an amazing thing to see, and it's great because I think it shows that the teams are much more imbalanced this year, this coming year. So, what do you think?
Yeah, I was actually a little disappointed with the results of the Jerez test because I thought we'd be around top five or somewhere banging around top five rather than, you know, eighth, ninth, and tenth. Or because I know the level of the bike, and that wasn't our true 800cc machine. We haven't physically built the bikes that we're going to be racing next year. But because of the time constraints and because the pieces are ready, as these bikes are still being developed and things are being modified, you know, almost on a daily basis, we actually borrowed a bike from Ducati. They loaned it to us and said, okay, you know, use this bike and see what you can do.
Yeah.
And I'm of the gut feeling that R800 was probably one of the first generation ones, whereas the factory guys might have been on a second generation. I know, and they've already publicized, they have 20 different engine configurations, you know, on the dyno. it is kind of crazy when you see how small the factory and the R&D department is, the Ducati Corsa department. But I'm really proud of Alex for getting out there and showing what he can do. Even if it was with a qualifier, I've read online already that some people think that running a qualifier, you know, in preseason is a useless thing. But it actually, because there's so much grip on the rear, it will point out any glaring flaws you have with your chassis that you might not be able to pick up on the race tire. You need to push the bike to the limit to know where any of the flaws are. And I think you and I were speaking about Jeremy Burgess saying that the bikes run faster in practice than they do in the race.
Yeah.
And this is so that they can flush out any of the strange things with the bike. I mean, if Rafi had found his problems with the chassis in last year's preseason, you know, he wouldn't have been qualifying 9th or 13th, you know, at some of the races in 2006, and he would have had to push so hard to get through the field, which is possibly what led to the engine failures that he suffered this year in France and Laguna Seca. So, as far as preseason testing, I think we just got to push as hard as you can and treat every session like a qualifying session. Go out and spend most of the hour working on your chassis and then say, all right, now that we think we've got it worked out and we think we've got the right setup, throw a cue on there and really bang one out and see what happens.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Also, because of the tire restrictions next year with the amount of tires we'll be able to use, it's important to get as much data as possible because you don't want to have a bike that runs great on a race tire and then you go out there on your cue and you fall flat on your face, and then there's just no way, unless you're, you know, Rossi, that you're going to knife through the field like he does. So, I don't know. Ideally, I think for me, I wouldn't have a qualifying tire, but that's a personal opinion. I'm not really in the queues.
Right. So, that actually brings me to the next thing, which is, if in fact you're on the racetrack and you're pushing as hard as you can, what about the other kind of development that you need to do? And when is that going to happen? Like, you know, race distance type fuel management and race distance, you know, just the motor holding together and that kind of testing. You know, with the ban coming up, I mean, actually it's in effect now, I guess, right? So,
yes.
You know, exactly how far does the ban extend, you know? That's a question that I've actually wanted to ask you for a while because I don't understand. The rules are very, very specific about not racing at a circuit, but that's it, you know?
Right. Well, these bikes are pretty useless anywhere else but a circuit. because you can't do any meaningful testing unless the bike is at the limit. That's why a test rider, you know, can't really, really determine chassis development if he's 2 to 3 seconds off the pace. Because unless the bike is at the limit, you won't feel that you know, split second of quiver in the front end or whatever. But as far as the testing ban, it means the rider can't ride the bike, basically.
So the official rider.
Be ridden.
What about a test rider? Okay, test riders also.
No, bikes don't get, the bikes won't run on a track, which isn't to say that the motors won't be on a dyno, that engineers aren't going to be refining parts and they load the motors on the dyno, because they want to see what's going to break. They want to see what's going to get stressed. They want to see how they can make it more efficient, you know, get cooled. They want to see how much power they can get based on their fuel curve. And, you know, with all the data that we record, even in a 5-lap session, we can predict quite a bit. So I think that's why we haven't seen too many of the riders go out and do race distance runs. It's more important to get as much chassis data as possible now in the preseason. So everyone's going out on different tires and experimenting with things and trying to see the flexibility of the bike in all conditions. And race distance will come later. Certainly, I think with the fuel limit dropping from 22 to 21 liters, that's going to cause some issues. It is possible to make more power the more fuel you spend. You know, I have no doubt that a GP bike could, you know, hit somewhere up near 300 horsepower if they wanted to, but it wouldn't last a race. And definitely, there's not enough fuel in the tank to go that long.
Right.
The fuel requirement is the biggest deal as far as slowing the bike down, in my mind.
Yeah, probably more than the CC drop.
I'm sorry?
Probably more than the CC drop.
Yeah, I mean, eventually I think we'll see the CCs knocked down again. Because there's, at the speeds we're going, if technology keeps improving, then the only way to kind of keep it near this level will be to drop the CCs again. And, you know, it's only going to benefit street bikes, I think, down the line to have such extreme testing done and understanding of flow and everything else that goes into making, you know, a combustion engine work. It really is the gnarliest test bed in the world for motorcycles.
The bikes, they can't be ridden, but they're definitely going to be running in the shop, in the garage. So does that mean that you guys, like, get no break at all? Are you going to get a vacation?
Well, I think now that I'm working so much with computers, I can work from any internet point on the planet. So if I do take a break, which I'm hoping to do, if I can afford it, I'll still be checking my email and working on the computer a couple times a day. I know that either later this week or next week, half of my team is going to the factory to start assembling our bikes. The second week of December is when my team is going to assemble our four race bikes. And then this week they're going to go study the data from the test and also learn about the new electronic systems, because the systems are different between the 990 and the 800. I mean, certain things will cross over, but there are new technologies involved. I think that's the same for every manufacturer. There's you can just think that Honda lopped off a cylinder, but there's a whole lot more that they did to that 800. It's really, really interesting, actually, looking at the chassis geometry of that bike.
Oh, yeah, and the exhaust system, too.
You know, I think that they might change that again.
Oh, yeah?
Because, you know, why not? There's a lot of time before the racing starts. I've always been I like long pipes, let me put it that way. I don't like really short pipes. And that's for drivability. It's the same principle that goes, you know, from a tractor engine, like an old Harley Davidson, while you run long pipes on a Harley, as opposed to short, you know, drag pipes, real short pipes. You know, the longer your pipe, the more torque you end up pulling out of the engine. That's to do with exhaust pulses and reversion, and you don't want sonic booms coming back through the pipe to impede your flow coming out of the ports. It's really fascinating stuff. But at the end of the day, it's just an exhaust pipe, you know. So there's so much more that goes into these pipes. There's so much more to consider. I don't know if any of the MotoGP OD listeners have been poking around at photos of the 800, but I've seen some photos of the Honda with the skins off. And I think their airbox design is really interesting this year. I mean, compared to a standard airbox design, it seems like a lot of sport bikes and even the GP bikes will have their snout coming through the front of the fairing, and it either goes through the forks or around the forks. And then it terminates into an airbox that sits right above the engine. But it looks like the new Honda 800 has dual airboxes, one on each side of the fork, before it goes in through the frame.
Wow.
Which I thought was pretty interesting. It might actually be a three-stage, you know, or a two-stage airbox system just to kind of have a ram air effect, but also keep the air at a constant normal pressure in the box. I'm not sure. I gotta ask somebody.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll tell you that one.
Yeah, a lot of neat stuff happening with these machines. Nice to see the Suzuki's up here.
Yeah. Of course, they've been up there before. I think that the Suzuki's have been up in front before during preseason testing, though.
Yeah. I mean, Hopper even led the race in France. So, I mean, he led it for a lot of laps, and then by the time he got pushed down to third, he lost it on the front, but they're looking good. A lot of people are looking good in preseason. The only thing I'm kind of sad about is that NKR is behind the eight ball again, like they were last year, where they spent 68 straight days building their bikes so they were ready for the IRTA test, and then they spent the first half of the season working it out.
Right.
I'd really like to see them competitive from day one. Because their package has a lot of potential. It's evident, especially in Estoril when Junior was leading the race with one lap left. Amazing.
He was only off like by 15/100ths.
Yeah.
Something like that. That's pretty amazing.
That's barely. Man. Oh, that was a wild race, I'll tell you.
It was. Where were you?
I was on pit wall for that race, running the board for Alex Hoffman. And I was right next to the Repsol booth, you know, literally just, I could have thrown my pit board at him. And I had Pooch on one side of me and my chief mechanic on the other side. And I remember watching the monitor to kind of see, you know, we've got additional timing available to us that you don't see on the website or anywhere around, so we can track our rider through the track. We know where he's at, you know. And so I'm watching that, and then I saw the crash between Danny and Hayden, and the first thing I did was look over at Pooch. So I got to see him react before they got the cameras on him, where you see him put his head in his hands. And that must have been a real stressful day for those guys.
So his reaction wasn't just shaking his head, it was more probably screaming?
Yeah, I would say he was a little bit upset before he kind of put his head in his hands and got a little resigned look on his face. You know, the initial reaction was like, whoa, glad I wasn't right there. But, you know, there's so much emotion that goes with racing. I think definitely this year I've learned to calm down quite a bit. The first couple races I did, I felt a little bit jumpy, and I had so much adrenaline running in me the whole time. In fact, every race I've gone to for the entire week, it seems like I don't need sleep because I've got so much adrenaline running through me. But in the last couple of races, I seem to have kind of gotten a handle on the travel routine and how to be calm and ready to focus. Because one of the true enemies that we fight around the world is exhaustion. And you know, there's nothing that's really said about it in any of the media or the press, because you know, it's just considered that, that we're the top of the top guys, or we're lucky to be here, so on and so forth. But it's really exhausting, and you know, you have to survive on such little sleep, and you have to work at such a feverish pace during the day that it's really easy to make a mistake or have a lapse in judgment or just forget to tighten something down or what have you. So it really takes a lot to be able to concentrate and multitask at this level, and a lot of people don't realize that lack of sleep, I'd say, is probably a huge factor even for the riders. I know that I don't really sleep when I'm at the races, but when I get to an airport, or I can sleep in a moving van going to the track or from the track, but when I get on a plane, I'll fall asleep as soon as I sit down and fold my arms. I won't feel it take off. I have people wake me up when we land, and I think, oh, we didn't even take off yet, you know, and I'm confused for a little while until I realize, oh, we're here. So that's kind of nice, actually. Another nice thing is, in Malaysia, we all picked up PSPs with the MotoGPOD game, or the MotoGP game, which allows us to battle wirelessly.
Nice.
So, yeah, we had to drive from Madrid to Lisbon for the Estoril race, and that was, I don't know, 7 or 8 hours, it seemed, in the van. So, four guys yelling at one another, playing each other on the Estoril track and on the PSP was kind of fun. You know, it's just one of those little stress relievers that you know, you look for any kind of stress relief you can get when you're in this job.
And who won?
I usually did pretty good. I did pretty good.
Nice.
But then again, I don't really like the PSP controls, like the physics engine of the game compared to the PS2 version, because you don't have separate braking controls. It's
right,
just
right,
one
right.
button, and I can't quite finesse it the way I like to. But hey, it's just a video game, you know. Good to see the track. I wish there were more than 8 the video game. So if you're thinking about buying the game, it's good, but playing 8 race tracks on it, so it's a little, you know, hit or miss. I hope in the future they put the rest of the tracks in, because I know that there's enough space on the UMD disc for them to do that. I don't know if they want to spend the money to do it. Anyway, I'm sure you've got some GP-related questions.
I was going to ask you also about, you know, any upcoming rules. There was some kind of rumors going around about, not for 2007, obviously, but 2008, possibly introducing a Formula One-style weight minimum weight requirement that includes the rider. And so, you know, obviously people start talking about Pedrosa. He's, you know, he's a small guy. He weighs a lot less than some of the other guys, and his advantage is therefore taken away, and that's the way it should be. And, you know, it just seems like one of the great things about MotoGP is that it's, you know, it's been around for, since 1949, and the rule book is still a manageable rule book, as opposed to, like, those giant tomes that Formula One has. And it just seems like every time you add these rules, you complicate the sport to the point where I don't know. I'm probably going to strike all this, Liam, because I'm not making sense.
Okay, I think as far as the rules, I like that the rules are so open, and so they leave so much flexibility for the manufacturer and their technical partners. I think the more rules that a series has, the more limiting it is. And this is supposed to be prototype racing. You know, balls out, whatever you want to do, however much money you can throw at it, whatever you want to do, just go out and do what you want. You mentioned a minimum weight requirement, and I think that's a bad idea. I think in the smaller categories, like a 125, it makes sense, because there's such a small amount of power. But I think on the big boy class, you know, it's a rider's skill, and I think it's his balls that are going to carry him through a race, especially a season, not just one race. And this is evidence. I mean, Pedrosa is the smallest kid on the block, but you see him getting into situations where it's just too wild and hairy. I mean, he obviously collided with Hayden, and you look a couple races before, he won the race by a mile at Donington, But earlier in the race, when he was trying to get around Melandri, you just saw him completely out of shape. I think winning at this level takes a certain maturity, and it does take some physical prowess. And I don't care how small he is. I mean, you look at Valis, who's not the smallest guy. He won the race at Valencia. Rossi continues to win.
Yep.
Hayden's 40 pounds up on Pedrosa. He wins. At this point, as much as we can say that yes, he has a braking and an acceleration advantage, you know, the results are that everybody else is winning also. So unless it was a total lock, you know, in a perfect world, the lightest guy would win every single time. But this is motorcycle racing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing is, he's actually disadvantaged by the fact that he's got less mass to muscle the bike around with. So then if you add ballast to the bike, just to make up for the fact that he doesn't weigh as much, that he's got even more mass to have to.
I agree.
Force, you know?
I agree. He is strong as an ox, though.
Sure. Obviously, everyone was surprised by, you know, his endurance level. They were saying he's not going to be able to do it. He could totally do it, but he also does get exhausted. I mean, he's the only rider that I've seen in recent years who didn't make it to the podium because he was just too tired, you know? And in pain, I guess, also, but...
Yeah, I would say more in pain, because they spoke a little bit about his injuries, you know, broken toe and gashed knee and whatnot, but, you know, I watched him walk around the paddock, and you could see how much agony he was in. I think I don't think we knew the full extent of his injuries. I don't know if he took a real hard shot to the tailbone or his lower back, but based on the way he was walking, that's what I think the injury was. Because he was definitely in a world of hurt. And after the magnificent showing in Malaysia, he just couldn't pull it through in the following two races. Granted, he's not known as a rain rider, and Phillip Island was just about the worst conditions you could hold a race in. So didn't really expect too much out of him there. But, yeah, I think... three races in a row after getting that dinged up. That surprised you, Rose, actually. That's the way I saw him walking around. And the injury held on for quite a while, because it was weeks that he was walking like that. Not just, you know, one bad week and then a little bit better the next week. He was dinged up for at least a month.
Okay, man, so I've got almost no time left here. And it's not letting me buy any extra credit, by the way. It's like, I have to wait.
Capped.
Yeah, I got capped. So,
well, I just want to say,
yeah, let's wrap it up for me.
I just want to say it's great that we've got MotoGPOD back, and thank you, Jules, for taking it by the horns and putting it out there for everybody. I really have enjoyed meeting with people around the world. I met a guy named Tom. And another fellow in Australia, in Phillip Island, that came up to say hi to me, and I've got another guy in Malaysia. I've met MotoGPOD listeners around the planet already. We all share that same passion for racing and same passion for MotoGP. So I think it's fantastic, actually, that it's getting back together, and I hope to be able to contribute more and either give, you know, race updates or so on and so forth, time permitting. Want to point out that we're on a cell phone right now that Jules is paying for, and it's because we couldn't get Skype to work. So thanks, Jules, for putting that out there and making the call.
Cool, man. Thanks a lot for your time, and we'll chat with you soon.
Perfect. Thanks, Jules. You take care.
All right, man.
Okay. Before I wrap it up, I read about this promotion on the Ducati online mailing list for oncycles.com. I thought it was a really amazing deal, so I'd share it with you. This is only good for residents of the United States, actually residents of the continental United States. So if you're not in the continental United States, sorry. OnCycles.com catalog, the Moto Millennia catalog, is $17. You buy it, and in addition to the catalog, you also get a $15 credit in the online store, you get free shipping for a year, and you get a one-year subscription to Road Racer X, plus a one-year subscription to Two Wheel Tuner, and a one-year subscription to Rob Report Motorcycling. Pretty cool deal. Catalog is very cool. Got cool stuff inside it. And I believe that the promotion is running for another week or so. So check it out. I'm going to have a link to that and some other links from the show on the MotoGPOD.com website in the notes section, the show notes section. I'm going to have a link to the OnCycles.com promotion, a link to MotoLiam.com, which is Liam Schubert's website, which is always really, really fun to read. There's some great photos on there and some great Liam insights. And I'll have a link also to the official Navy Seabees website so you can read about what Bob's up to, kind of. Okay. That's the end of episode 71. There will be one more show, like I said, before the end of the year, and then in 2007 we'll have a more regular schedule. So please tune in. Thanks for listening. Ciao.